The Alabama Crops Report Podcast, your trusted information source for Alabama agriculture.
Hey, everybody. Welcome into another episode of the Alabama Crops Report Podcast. Simmer, we're going to do a little bit different today. We've gone outside of Auburn for a guest.
I was thinking about it just that. Is Wilson our first industry guest on the podcast?
He is, yeah.
All right.
There you go.
So we have Wilson Faircloth with us from Syngenta. Wilson, appreciate you driving over to Auburn from Georgia to visit with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for the invite.
So we'll introduce the topic in a second, but just introduce yourself.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be here. It's good to be back in Auburn. For those that don't know, I am Wilson Faircloth. I'm an agronomy service representative with Syngenta Crop Protection. I grew up in the state of Georgia. I got a degree in plant biology from University of Georgia, but I spent 7 years here on the plains, got my master's and PhD in weed science. So it's always good to come back to Auburn. And I've been spent a while with USDA at the National Peanut Research Lab and have been with Syngenta for right at 15 years now. And working on the technical side of things, the agronomy service is basically technical services, you know, helping sales reps in their territories, managing the technical aspects, developing products, not R&D necessarily, but taking those products right when they're ready to be commercialized and turning them into something that farmers can actually use on their farm.
And for our YouTubers out there, they may know the peanut doctor.
They may.
Yeah.
Yeah, that moniker has gotten some legs under it. And so, you know.
How did it start?
Well, good question. So we had a team that does our, you know, marketing and things like that, and they knew that I had spent time at the peanut lab and that I had my PhD, and somehow somebody come up and said, well, you're the peanut doctor. And then they began a marketing campaign all around it, and it was pretty clever, you know, and it's been fun. So
yeah.
We've got YouTube videos, we've got a giant peanut
dressed up like a doctor.
Like a doctor.
Yep,
and
yep.
I have been known to wear a doctor's coat sometimes.
Yeah.
All in fun and games. I don't wear it normally.
yeah, that's what I would say too.
I don't wear it in the peanut field.
I guess my other question, when you were at Auburn, who did you work with?
Yeah, good question. So back in the way back, you guys were young.
Yeah.
I came to Auburn in the fall of 97, and I worked with Dr. Mike Patterson, who is an extension weed specialist.
Okay.
And I did my master's under Mike, and then switched gears. I did cotton weed control, and then you know, an emerging thing at that time right around the year 2000 was invasive species really getting a lot of traction. So I spent most of my PhD actually working on cogon grass down in South Alabama, Mobile, Baldwin counties, burned up I-65.
I was gonna say, at least you got to go close to campus to
yes
that.
Exactly. Yeah. Spent a lot of road miles, but enjoyed my time here, and of course I stayed in touch with all the row crop stuff, but you know, it was nice getting a diverse background of weed science, not only the row crop stuff, but non-crop land, rights of way. Got a lot of funny looks doing research alongside I-10 in Baldwin County.
I can imagine, yeah.
Understanding the effect of a semi-truck on a four-nozzle spray boom. That's something you don't encounter every day.
That's not in literature, I'm
it's
sure.
Not, it's, there's no documented way to deal with that. That's right.
Well, Simmer, kind of my idea of inviting Wilson on the podcast was a couple of weeks ago now, or maybe a month or so, at the Southern Peanut Growers Conference. I heard, in my opinion, the three best back-to-back-to-back extension talks I've ever heard. That was Dr. Taylor Singleton, right, who's the
sustainability specialist at Georgia.
University of Georgia. Dr. Mark Abney, who's the extension peanut entomologist. And Dr. Wilson Faircloth with Syngenta. And kind of the theme was Taylor talked about the role of the Endangered Species Act and those types of things on where we are with current registrations of materials we already have or new ones. Mark talked about the role of the university or the land grant system in helping bring along new products. And then Wilson talked about kind of, he spoke on behalf of industry, obviously with the Syngenta flair, but on top of it, on behalf of industry on bringing in new products. And when I talked to some farmers or overheard farmers in the background talking, everybody was just like shocked when they heard Wilson's talk, because it's a little bit inside baseball, I would say, Wilson, on some things that you know, maybe we know some of that kind of stuff just from, you know, talking with you, you know, during the year or whatever, but most people who aren't involved at some level don't know that. Farmers don't, you know, don't know. Retailers don't know what all goes into it.
Well, even to some extent, and I was just thinking about this, last 4 or 5 years only, you know, with a lot of like other dicamba stuff or some other peanut even insecticide stuff happening where they're not available anymore, all that. One of the things you always kind of hear people like, well, there aren't new chemistries out there, you know, and it's more kind of just questioning like, hey, companies aren't developing new products, you know. So you kind of even like, I don't know yet because, you know, again, you listen to the talk, so you know a lot more. To my, like, I'm like, what does it really take to bring a product?
Well, with that comment, let's ask the first question. And I won't ask to give away any of your company secrets, but on average, about how many molecules are is one of the, quote, big basic companies looking at?
Yeah, sure. So good question. And it is a little bit of a peek behind the curtain as to what's involved. So, Simmer, I'm glad this is kind of like you're hearing it fresh for the first time. You're getting a refresher. But on average, companies like Syngenta, Bayer Crop Science, Corteva, whoever it is, we're all consider ourselves R&D companies. That's what we do is we develop new tools. But you're looking at about screening anywhere from 150 to 175,000 different molecules to find one. So just one that you may bring to market. And I thought about this on the drive over this morning. How do you picture that? 175,000 to one. And of course, the one analogy that kicks off tomorrow night is college football, right? Yeah. We love college football. So I thought about this: if you took you know, our two favorite schools in here, right? Well, Scott, you might disagree. University of Georgia and Auburn University. You take Sanford Stadium, holds about 95,000 people. Jordan-Hare holds about 87, something like that. Yeah. That's about 175,000 people altogether. So imagine giving one person in one of those two stadiums a $100 bill and say, go find it.
Yeah.
That's kind of brings it into perspective of what you're looking for. Now, there's tools and shortcuts we can use to get to that. We might, you know, first of all, you could eliminate all the students because nobody under 30 carries cash anymore, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's right.
So, you know, we automatically know that it's going to be an old guy, right?
Yeah.
But so there's tools we can use to narrow that down, but still it's about 175,000 different screenings and testings of different molecules to get to the one product that you're going to bring to market.
Are these products usually just that one molecule, or is it a combination of a few different?
So a lot of times it's a suite of molecules that are similar. So let's just say and it's not as random as you think. It's not like there's just a guy in a laboratory, you know, pouring up two
the
test
peanut
tubes
doctors
and, yeah, and hoping that maybe this will kill pigweeds, you know, or maybe this will kill cotton jassids.
Yeah.
You know, usually it's a targeted approach that says, I want to develop an insecticide that has the following properties. You know, it's it'll kill Lepidoptera insects, but it won't kill whatever else. And so they have a focus. And a lot of times as they narrow these things down, they may have 2 to 3 isomers that they bring that are, you know, cousins of each other. They behave similarly, but maybe have slightly different characteristics, because undoubtedly one or two of those is not going to pass some final test, whether it's toxicity, whether it's something as simple as there's no way we'll be able to manufacture it at a cost that a farmer could afford. So you bring 2 or 3 things to select one. Okay. So it is kind of a group of chemistry, usually, you know, some, you know, slight change. I'm not a chemist, but, you know, some slight molecular change that then you can decide which one of those you're going to take to the final marketplace. It's a good question.
175,000. Wow.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
And so, all right, so let's say we find our molecule. What's it look like from there? So you've already mentioned, okay, this one kills. We'll just say cotton jassids, because why not? So we've identified this. It kills this insect. Then what do you do?
That's right. Well, you have to back up a little bit. That 175,000 is, you know, if that's day one, then by the time you get to that product that you realize, number one, you can, you know, it has the efficacy you're looking for, it has the toxicity profile that you're looking for, it has the environmental safety, the human safety, and it's a product we can make at a reasonable cost. In other words, it start, you know, checking these boxes, you're talking at least 12 years in this process.
Just for filtering out.
Yes, for filtering it down and going through the final stages of testing. But you're looking at 12 years, and that contrast, that's why the meeting you were talking about, Scott, was important, because around the year 2000 up to about 2005, we could get from that 12 years was only about 8 years, maybe 8 to 9. So in the last 20 years, we're adding length to that time. So similar to your point of what are the chemical companies doing? How come I'm not seeing new products? Well, not only are they hard to find, but they take so long to get them to where we need them to be, because you have to do all the testing, and you do more testing than you could even want to do, because you got to make sure you cross every T and dot every I. You have to.
Is the reason for more time also that it's getting harder and harder to find because some of the options already been exploited in a way that, right? But is it also partly because of the restrictions getting a little bit more test, requiring more harder testing?
Yeah, it's both. And so, again, back to the analogy of the guy in the laboratory, pouring up our test tubes, we know that, okay, a certain class of chemistry is effective on, again, which, since we're talking about JASIDs, we'll use JASIDs. We know this is effective on JASIDs. So we take that molecule and we twist it a little bit, or we add, something to it, or we take something away and we try that. So it's a targeted approach. And so, yeah, we begin to exhaust a lot of the things we've done. And so the process does take longer because you look at the number of compounds that are on the cutting room floor at this point, it's millions, right? Because if everyone's 175,000, do the math.
Yeah.
I mean, we've studied literally tens of millions of compounds over the years to see what we can use. But so it is harder to find the thing you want, but also you're correct. The testing process, I mean, we want to be safe. I mean, that, that we absolutely don't want to cause harm to the environment or harm to each other. And so the testing gets more and more rigorous, and we have to meet those standards. And just like anything else, the testing itself is undergoing research and development. Tests get better. Sometimes they get harder. And so, it just takes longer to get that. And with like anything, sometimes you reach a plateau, and then sometimes you actually go backwards a little bit. You think, well, I've got the compound I want. Then you get a report that you don't like. And so you have to back up, and maybe you make some changes, maybe, and then you go forward again. So it's not just a stair step. It's not always linear.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's a little bit of a curve, a little bit of roller coaster ride sometimes to get those products to the market.
And there's a really important thing hidden in there that hasn't been mentioned yet, and we'll probably tie it in later. But as soon as you identify something that you think maybe has a shot, you got to go ahead and patent it.
Oh, that's
because,
right.
Because company A's got 175,000 things or whatever. Company B's got it. Company C's got it. And you just can't bet, well, we're so much better than them. We found this and they didn't. So as soon as you patent it, your clock's ticking.
Yeah, you got to collect data and show that.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah.
And then it is 20 years for a patent. Is that right?
It's 18, actually, I think.
18 years.
Right.
And so on average, it's taking you 12 years to get it to market. So you've only got 6 years left on your patent.
But do you patent after 12 years when you find it, or you go ahead and do it?
I'm not a lawyer, but you have to patent it pretty early on in the process, because like you say, somebody else, if you don't do it, somebody else will.
Okay.
To Scott's point, chemists are, we all know what we're looking for.
Yeah.
So a lot of, if you consider it like a gold mine, we're all looking in the
same
mine.
Yeah, and in a way, a patent is not tied to that you actually have the product ready. It's
correct.
It's like, hey, this is our idea, and
yes,
this is what, yeah, so okay.
Yeah.
Because other thing, and I've only dealt with a little bit of patents and other stuff on the technology side or machinery side, and I know that like once you say, hey, we have this patent, we want to file all this, you have, I don't know, so many months or years that you actually got to show, prove the data and all that.
Right.
Is that a similar timeline kind of in the chemical side?
I don't know for sure, but I would expect that
because
there has
like
to be some sort of time of proving your concept.
Yeah, so like I may be misspeaking, but I know it's a very short time on the machinery or technology. If you think you have the next technology, everything, and you start to patent it, you have like a year to 18 months to like actually go out, prototype, test it, collect data to make sure they hold the patent for you. If not, they release it,
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's just competition thing. Yeah. Like, you don't want to say, I have an idea and take 20 years, sit on it while they're like, well, we already developed the product, company B is, you know, like, yeah, we have ready to launch.
Yeah. Well, the development is, it's gotten more complex. You know, I look back, again, when I was first a graduate student, you know, here at Auburn in 97, we were at the end of the glory days, let's just say, of some of our pesticide discovery, especially herbicides back then in the 80s and 90s. It was great, right? Because if company A came out, I'll take the dinitroanilins, which are like our yellow herbicides, like Prowl or Treflan. Company A came out with one. Everybody else knew that we could take that base molecule, we could twist it a little way, or we could add a little something to it. Oh, now we got us one too. And so that's why you had all these different herbicides that look very similar. Maybe they had slightly, you know, one's better on pigweed, one's not quite as good on pigweed, or et cetera. But those days are likely over because we've exhausted all those possibilities, that there's no longer that room that, oh, I can just take molecule X and add another hydrogen group to it, and all of a sudden I've got one too, you know. So it's, and AI, I'll bring that up. AI is changing the way we're developing herbicides, or not herbicides, but all pesticides. I'm not going to sit here and pretend I even know how, but we all use ChatGPT for fun. You know, we tell it to make a funny picture, or we, you know, get it to roast our family Easter picture, whatever it is. But AI is the machine learning and intelligent learning like that is helping our chemists accelerate that process, you know, a lot faster. So yeah, there's some good, it's not all doom and gloom. There are things that are helping us, you know, do better in the discovery process.
It's become, I know I've seen a lot of kind of, because some of our colleagues, they do high throughput phenotyping work and all that for selecting cultivars and all that. And like with AI, they say what used to take us months now takes less than a week because we can feed the data to the model and we tell the model what we're looking for.
Correct.
And it goes straight to that without someone sitting there in the lab and just like taking a look and comparing results across each other.
That's right.
So that's definitely going to hopefully help even on the chemical side, right?
Right.
Even though you said we went from 8 years to 12 years, who knows, that might help even push it back.
Yeah, I think one way AI has helped is a little bit with the cost. Now, costs are still extraordinary and they're still going up, but it, you know, if you can take away parts, the cost of some parts, then that helps. And so I think AI is going to help with some of that because some of our traditional wet chemistry that we may have to do in the laboratories, we may not have to do because the AI can say, you know what, let's just eliminate this group of compounds from, if you're trying to kill, you know, pest X, AI can say there's no way these compounds are going to do that. So we can just take them off the table from the start. So, you know, just narrowing down, you know, going back to our stadium analogy of trying to find that $100 bill, if we, you know, it's a Georgia fan, then we don't have to look in Jordan-Hare Stadium, right? We don't have to look there for the guy with the $100 bill. We can just look in Athens, you know, so we can use AI to narrow down where we look.
And I was thinking about how the industry works in that perspective. So when this is in the R&D team side.
That's right.
So when we're talking about a team from industry side working on something like that, are there a group of people, only a couple people, or is it a huge team, have different functions? Or
yeah, it's multidisciplinary. I mean, you've got biologists that screen the compounds that they're looking at, you know, does it really kill a pigweed or not? Or does it, you know, kill a peanut, right? I mean, if it kills a peanut, who cares if it kills pigweeds? And you've got chemists, you've got biochemists, you've got molecular biologists, physicists. I mean, you've got, and you got mathematicians and everybody else in between to help conduct that process. So yeah, it's very multidisciplinary in its approach.
Yeah, because I was just thinking, we usually say industry is so fast, even it takes time on coming up with this versus university research. If we have to come up, I don't think we have the resources or the power or something like that, right? Yeah. I was thinking about like our lead scientist friends or other, like, can they come up with a new compound? Yeah. Probably.
Well, I mean, every once in a while you get good luck in developing compounds, but those are few and far between. And I've used the example of mesotrione, which is a common corn herbicide. People know it as Callisto, and it's an ingredient. That product was found a little bit serendipitously by a scientist who noticed under the bottle brush plant, nothing grew. So he extracted, and again, I'm not, this isn't the exact story, but he figured out what it was that the bottle brush plant was exuding from its roots. He mimicked it in the laboratory, and all of a sudden he had a blockbuster corn herbicide that's used all around the world. Nice. So sometimes you get lucky,
mm-hmm.
but most of the time you don't. You have to be intentional. You have to be, you know, you have to look for that needle in the haystack. But every once in a while you get lucky on something like that.
Roundup was kind of like that too, wasn't it?
I've heard stories that it was like a really being looked at as a cleaner or sort of an industrial.
And they noticed cleaner. Where they poured it out, like nothing grew.
Nothing grew.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that story before.
We'll have to ask Vent Hicks.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So what is the next thing? Is time is one thing. Cost.
Yeah. Well, time is money. That's what they say. And costs are high. So I tried to walk through in that presentation how things have changed over time, because a lot of people remember what it used to be like, and they don't realize, to your point, of how much things have changed. And so going back to our, you know, turn of the century analogy of it was maybe 8 to 10 years to develop a new compound. At that time, you're looking at a cost of maybe $150 million. To bring a product to market. And I say those numbers, if you're wondering where I got that number, there's some really good data published by Crop Life America, mm-hmm. which Crop Life America is a broad organization that represents a lot of big companies in research and development. So that's not a Syngenta number, that's some data I got off their website. But they estimated at that time, you know, about $150, $160 million to bring that product to market, to include the investment by the chemical company or the registrant, into research and development, registration, formulation, all that stuff. If you fast forward, the latest data we have from Crop Life America ended in 2020, I believe it was, and it was about $325 million.
Yeah.
Golly.
So that kind of puts into perspective the amount of money that companies are investing. So, you know, you get the common feedback, man, why does your stuff cost so much? Well, that's one reason why, because the investment to get it to where we can sell it to you is in excess. And that's 5 years ago, right? 6 years ago. So I just did an estimate on my own. I think it's probably closer to $400 million now in 2025 dollars.
And you consider your patent life has been reduced as
that's
well.
Correct.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so that impacts how long you have opportunity to.
Now, just remember, too, we're not talking about one product that you can sell. That would be one active ingredient. So
that's right.
And from that active ingredient, you may sell 5 different products in the United States, to include, well, you might sell some in Brazil, you might sell some in China or India or wherever else. So it's not like that's just one product that you can sell, but that's one active ingredient that you can then take and use, and you know, you may pre-mix it with other products, you may sell it solo. But yes, you're still looking at, you know, $300 to $400 million per active ingredient that you bring in that's new into the marketplace.
If we had to look back, just say as a decade, over the last 3, 4, 5 decades, how many chemistries per decade have been released? Or is there some new that came out like?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if I have numbers for you, but I can say this. We kind of referenced it earlier that the 60s, 70s, and 80s were some of the golden ages of chemical discovery. And again, we're going back, you know, 50, 60 years, those products came out, different landscape, different time frame. Some of that's good, some of that's bad, right? Because we know things about toxicity we didn't know back then. But those were the years when you know, a small company could come out with a compound and they could sell it and make a lot of money and really do a lot of good for farmers. It has greatly slowed down. If it was a curve, it would be a huge, it'd have a much of a curve to it. Just for example, I think one chemical company has a new herbicide that they either launched last year or this year. That's the first new mode of action in herbicides, I think they said, in 20 years. New mode of action. That's not to mean the first new herbicide, but the first new mode of action in 20 years. Now, insecticides have had a few more discoveries and different modes of action, but just using weed science as a discipline, over the last 20 years, one new mode of action.
Wow.
And that's incredible. So it's been a huge slowdown in what we can bring to the market as far as new chemistries. And again, anybody can, not anybody, but you can synthesize something that we already know works, but now the magic is finding those new modes of action, because we're getting resistance, whether it's insecticide, whether it's a herbicide, fungicide. We've got to find new ways of overcoming resistance.
And that's part of why we're going to have crops that are genetically altered for 4 or 5 herbicides soon.
Yeah.
Because right? We can't find anything new, so we've got to figure out how can we spray what we have over these crops without killing them.
That's exactly
right. It's crazy.
So there's all this going on the chemical side, but then breeding efforts on crops for some of...
Yeah, trying to identify how can we, if we can't find a new herbicide, how can we alter the cotton plant so we can use what we have without killing it?
Yeah.
Is kind of the easiest option, I assume.
That's right. And I don't know near as much about cotton and soybean and corn, which there's tons of, you know, trait work going on in those areas, but just take peanut for example. Most of your modern breeding efforts or current breeding efforts are looking at where can we find wild species that have a tolerance to leaf spot or white mold. And I know every major peanut breeder, whether it's Charles Chin here at Auburn or Barry Tillman at Florida or Nino and Bill over at UGA, they've got lines that have resistance to fungicide or to fungus. Mm-hmm. And so from a chemical perspective, I'm like, I don't know if I like that or not. But at the same time, we have to have it, right? Because our fungicides, we don't have a new mode of action right now. And so if we wear out the ones we have, then that's, you know, too bad. I mean, what are we going to do? It's good that breeders are looking at this. And you know, they have some just using peanut examples, some really good tolerance to early and late leaf spot, and that's incredible, and it may change the way we manage peanuts moving forward, and I look forward to the challenge of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it may change the way I do things, who knows. I imagine Mother Nature will always find a way to come up with something to throw at us.
Like
on the jazz. On the peanuts, I always kind of think about this. I remember Ping Chi talking one time in a cotton breeder at UGA,
right.
You know, like somebody asked him about like cotton variety or something like, and he like, it takes a lot to release a variety, you know, like we're talking about chemistry too. On the peanut side, so on the cotton, corn, beans, there's a lot of these big companies releasing commercial varieties and all that. Why hasn't that happened in peanuts?
Yeah, good question. I guess, and you look at the overall footprint of peanuts, in Georgia, Alabama, Florida, we think it's a big deal. It's one of the main drivers of what we do in agriculture. We plant cotton because it's a good rotation for peanut, right?
Mm-hmm.
We plant corn because it's a good rotation for peanut. If you're a company like Syngenta and you can, you know, you have that carrot in front of you of 100 million acres of corn and soybeans, or you got 1 million acres of peanuts, where are you going to put your money?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think I'm speaking on behalf of all chemical companies.
Yeah.
It's a logical decision that, of course, if I was in charge, I'd be like, peanuts first. But
yeah.
I mean, we,
well,
we
that,
can't do that, you know?
It kind of relates so much to what we do. I always kind of take example of all these planting technologies, spray technologies. There's so much geared towards corn beans, you know, that either we have something for cotton, maybe to some extent, or completely not for cotton and peanuts, because they're like, oh, we treat that as a specialty crop in a way, you know, and we make stuff for a specialty crop.
Yep.
Yeah, and in the discovery process, that's exactly right. Often, specialty crops get the second look. In other words, we're screening it for efficacy in the major crops around the world: rice, cereals, corn, soy. Those are the biggies. So vegetables, peanuts, and then like where I live near Albany, Georgia, pecans,
mm-hmm.
You know, we're not out looking for a new pecan scab material. We get a new pecan scab material when we find out that it's good somewhere else. And oh yeah, it's also good on pecans, by the way.
Yeah.
So, or pecans, however you want to say it.
Pecans.
I was going to ask him, what do you call it?
Pecan.
No, that's pecan. Wrong. That's absolutely wrong.
That's a
A pecan is, well, I won't say the pecan. Wilson, one other point that you've alluded to several times, but I think it's important for us just to say it because of, again, I heard 4 farmers talking about this after your talk, is the level of investment that your company, Bayer, Corteva, BASF, that they put into research and development of new products that if you're not those big, did I name everybody? I don't want to leave anybody out. Syngenta, BASF,
FMC.
FMC.
Yep. There's others.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah, don't want to leave anybody out, but the big companies are the ones that are using money to find new stuff, not just selling old stuff that's off patent. And I think that's important that y'all can't go out of business, because that's how we get new stuff. Because to your point, Simmer, if we try to do it in academia, it'll take our whole career to come out with one thing that...
If we find anything.
Yeah, if we find anything. It'll take 40 years. So I just think that's a very important point.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. And again, it's... the products that we sell now are the fuel for the engine.
Yes.
Right? If you think of this thing as an engine, if you're not buying the products from Syngenta now, then Syngenta doesn't have the money to develop the next thing. It's not like we can go, we're a private corporation. We can't go to the government and get a grant to try to develop the next pesticide. So we do rely on our customers, again, not just Syngenta. I'm wearing my industry hat as a whole now. We appreciate the support of our farmers, because when you invest in the product we sell today, then that allows us to bring you the product tomorrow that you really need for the pest that you may not even know that we're going to have.
Like cotton jazz.
Yeah, like cotton jazz. I mean, our new insecticide, I use that as an example. You buy, peanut fungicides from Syngenta now, you're helping make sure that this new product gets kicked across the finish line, and that hopefully next year we can send this jacid back where it came from.
Yeah. So. Simmer can take it.
Yeah.
Hey. So is it, going back to your point, and I see there's a lot of similar other things, not just like, because we're always complaining about something, why this is not available, this is not coming, all that. Is it because, again, it goes back to how we are promoting certain things in ag in a way? Or is there not enough transparency and light on like what you're like sharing now? Like, hey, because after knowing about it, you have a little bit of appreciation for like, man, they're working all the time to find this, right?
Yes, but at the end of the day, in the current economic landscape we have in production agriculture, if you can save $3 an acre, that's a big deal. And that's kind of what's driving it is price. And
yeah,
they can get something cheaper.
That's right. And there's a time and a place for everything. But it would be the same thing whether you go from ag, if you go to pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy brand name pharmaceuticals, you're doing the same thing. You're supporting the development of the next cancer treatment drug.
Yeah.
You think about that. And I'm the first one to go in the dollar store and just buy the house brand. And I need to think about that. Is that, should I be doing that? Or should I be buying the name brand stuff so that, the next thing that's like COVID, whenever it comes out, well, we'll have something to treat it. So, it is important. And it's a lot of just lack of information, Simmer. That's a good question, of not thinking that, oh, if I buy this, I'm helping make sure that I have the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
It's an investment. It really is an investment. It's not just chemical companies trying to get rich. I'm not saying people in Syngenta or Bayer and other places don't make good money or that the companies aren't profitable. But at the end of the day, we invest. I think that the last number I heard with Syngenta is about $2 billion a year into R&D. That's billion with a B. A lot of the money of the products you buy is coming right back in. Again, to that engine, it's the fuel that keeps this thing running.
Good deal.
All right. Well, anything else?
No, I appreciate y'all letting me come on. I mean, one thing we didn't talk about real quickly is biologicals. And I just wanted to mention that, I see biologicals as a little bit of a workaround on some of this thing as far as developing things new. I mean, the timeline is going to be less because they're generally considered safer, they're going to be a little easier to get through the process. So right now, biologicals, I use the example, it's kind of like the guy with the electric car 10 years ago. We all made fun of him because they weren't very good. But now, everywhere you go, there's Teslas, and they're great cars.
Yeah.
5 years from now, we may be talking about how good biologicals are. So I feel like they're going to hit every major company's investing in biologicals. Maybe they're not a big deal today, but I think they will be. And when they get here, I think that'll help us, again, just be another tool in our toolbox to be able to bring solutions to farmers quicker.
To that point, kind of, you brought up a really good point in your presentation that turned into a preliminary exam question for Caitlin.
Oh, good.
That was, if you could create an insecticide, what would you want it to have? And nearly every one of those characteristics makes it harder to get it through.
Right.
Yeah. Right? Broad spectrum, long residual, whatever. makes it harder. Mm-hmm. Biologicals maybe can help us get around that a little
bit.
That's correct. Yeah. But that also is part of why you mentioned sometimes you think you're getting close and then you hit a roadblock and you got to step back and start over because maybe the residual is too long or it is too broad spectrum or whatever. So that just triggered in my brain when you mentioned biologicals.
Is it possible, and maybe I'm ignorant on this area right now, I've seen a lot of kind of biological work and all that focused on the nutrient side more, like uptake efficiency and others.
Sure, yeah.
You think in the near future we might see something similar for insecticide, fungicides, all to make them work better?
Yeah, absolutely. I think every major company has some sort of division that's working on biologicals, whether it is like almost like a catalyst to make a pesticide work better, or whether it itself is a pesticide, but a biologically derived pesticide. I think everybody's looking at that and thinking that could really help us. And again, maybe they're not ready today. And, you know, sometimes somebody has a biological and we all snicker a little bit like, it's biological. It's not very good. Yeah. But again, just like the old guy with the old electric car, one day we're all going to want
high yield growers swear by it, man.
Yeah, you know, one day we're going to want one.
Guys who are using it and making some good yields, like a lot of times you hear them, they mention those in there.
That's right.
Like, that's not the only thing making high yields, but they like, we do use those. So,
yeah.
I don't know if they got something figured out there or working with the right people in the industry to make sure that everything else they're working. The biologicals help even them become more effective or something like that.
That's right.
Pretty cool.
Well, Wilson, we appreciate your time and your insight.
Yeah, thank you for letting me come on. This has been a very, very good conversation.
Yeah, we also appreciate you working with us and, you know, helping us get our hands on new products that come out so we can help make the best recommendation for farmers when new things do come to the market. And I'm not speaking just for myself, but for, you know, weed scientists and pathologists and everything, that we appreciate the ability to see this stuff before it's ready to go, because that really helps us.
Yeah, well, thank you for letting me come on. But also, again, to your point, we can't do it without the university involvement. We need your critique of our products to say, hey, this is good, or hey, this may not work so good for our growers or for our situation, or your, you know, suggestion of, hey, have you thought about this? Thank you for bringing the cotton jacid to our attention.
Yeah.
I think it would have come to our attention
He's talking to you, Samer.
just to mention, to highlight that point, Jack, we were riding back from lunch with, I had a visitor from Brazil, Dr. Lucas, and we were just talking, and he's like, university industry seems to like work very close here. I'm like, that's kind of our strength right here.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
In the South or in the where we are, and I've been in Georgia here, other states, that we're all working towards the same problem. It's like we're working together.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, appreciate everybody's time today. Enjoyed our conversation. And as always, if any of us at Alabama Extension can do anything to help, please don't hesitate to reach out and let us know.
The Alabama Crops Report is a production of the Alabama Cooperative Extension System.